we spend a lot of time thinking about big issues needing big resolution or big fixes, but sometimes it's the smallest things that have the most impact for the lives of the people who get these benefits.
That's Eastern Illinois professor Michael Gillespie talking to us about SNAP benefits last summer. Today, why lower and middle income families continue to struggle and what should be done about it. Plus, it took months for people in Champaign County to learn about a gas leak that affected their water. State Senator Chapin Rose thinks this whole situation is unacceptable.
I would like to see us change the entire system so that you don't have to go to court months later to force a cleanup.
And the state treasurer has a new plan to help Illinois farmers and homeowners. Also, we continue our series of interviews with candidates for attorney general. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Our unemployment rate in Illinois is finally back down. It's actually at its lowest since 2006. But how much is that helping our low and middle income residents? Not as much as you would think. And when you look at the gap between our wealthiest and poorest residents, the richest 20% of households in Illinois earned five times more than the poorest 20%. That's according to the annual scorecard from Prosperity Now. They're a nonprofit that analyzes how and why low and middle income families struggle despite economic improvements. Prosperity Now, in its report released this morning, found that Illinois improved just one spot overall in its annual ranking from 30th nationally to 29th. Joining us now is Jody Blaylock. She's a senior policy associate at the Chicago-based Heartland Alliance and is the Prosperity Now lead in Illinois. Hi, Jody. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Jody, can you tell us a little bit more about how Prosperity Now creates a scorecard? What are the issues that you all look at?
Sure. So Prosperity Now, this scorecard is released every year, and it evaluates all 50 states across 62 different indicators in five different areas, including things like assets and income, businesses, jobs, education, and healthcare. Really all to get a sense of how families are faring financially. And, you know, a big piece of the scorecard, as you mentioned, is it ranks all of the states. And here in Illinois, as you mentioned, this year we ranked 29th. And while that is a very small improvement over last year's ranking of 30th, we still here in Illinois really have quite a long way to go to making sure that all families share in the economic gains that we're seeing.
Jody, when we talk about financial assets, what does it look like in terms of savings rates among our poorest residents in Illinois?
Sure. So, you know, last year, you know, we're really seeing that a lot of families are really struggling to save. While lots of people, when given the opportunity, can and do save, the reality is that a lot of incomes are simply too low, especially here in Illinois. Our minimum wage is still pretty low, and families simply can't really afford to get ahead on such a low income rate. That's why we were heartened to see the state increase the earned income tax credit last year. That will give families a much needed income boost. But I think we're really still struggling to see families get ahead. As you mentioned, the poorest 20% are really not sharing in the gains, the economic gains that we're seeing across the board. So a lot of the gains from the economy are going to the wealthiest 20%. And so here in Illinois, that income inequality has been increasing over the past year.
I want to ask you about the earned income tax credit in just a minute, but I want to ask first also about housing costs. How much do housing costs in Illinois play a rate into how much people are able to save, how much people are able to have sort of, I guess, even how much people are living paycheck to paycheck?
Sure. So the scorecard data revealed that 48.6% 6% of renters in Illinois are cost burdened. So we're really seeing that affordable housing is a major issue for families here in Illinois. And certainly, you know, that is one of the biggest costs month to month for any family. But here in Illinois, we're really seeing that as a big piece that is holding families back. And when you pay such a large chunk of your monthly income just to cover rent and housing, it really doesn't leave the money that you need to afford everything else, from food to, you know, to medicine and you know, that's setting aside trying to save and actually, you know, put aside some money for a rainy day. So we really see housing costs eating away at families' scarce budgets.
Judy, you mentioned the earned income tax credit. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So the earned income tax credit is a federal tax credit for low and moderate income working families. It really has broad bipartisan support, because it helps lift working families out of poverty while encouraging work. And so for many low-income families, this is the biggest one-time income boost that they get all year. And so a lot of folks rely on it to pay down debt, increase their savings, or invest in big purchases. Here in Illinois, we are one of 29 states that have established a state-level earned income tax credit in addition to the federal tax credit. And as I mentioned before, Illinois actually took a great step forward last year by expanding the state-level EITC from 10% to 18% of the federal credit, which will give families a little bit of an extra income boost moving forward.
Do you think that's part of what contributed to our ranking going up?
I do believe that that is why we saw Illinois move in the rankings from 30th to 29th, along with, you know, some other factors. But I do think that was a big piece of the puzzle. And so I really hope that Illinois lawmakers will see this and be encouraged by that finding, but also note that we still need to see a lot of other bold solutions to make sure that families are getting ahead. We're still only ranked 29th, and I think we still have a ways to go here in Illinois.
That's Jody Blaylock. She's a senior policy associate at Heartland Alliance in Chicago. She's the Prosperity Now Illinois lead. We're going to tweet out a link to that scorecard, by the way. If you'd like to see more of that data, follow 21ST Show. I want to bring a couple more people into the conversation here. Grant Schubert works for the Rock River Valley United Way in Rockford, where he's the community impact manager. I'm also joined by Michael Gillespie. He's an associate professor of sociology at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. His research focuses on poverty and food insecurity. Both of you, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Grant, can I ask you, you're working directly with people who are struggling to make ends meet. I wonder how much the things Jody mentioned are what you're seeing people deal with. Are housing, work issues. What are the most common, I guess, minimum wage issues? What are the most common issues you're seeing with people in Rockford?
Well, I think, you know, I think everything she said is very accurate, and you see it in the neighborhoods every day. The neighborhood I work in, Midtown in Rockford, Illinois, is almost kind of in the latter stages of that. We're dealing with a lot of vacant buildings, a lot of, you know, just desolation, a lot of houses being torn down, and a ton of renters. And so what does it do for your neighborhood if, you know, the property values are going down and you're kind of losing this neighborhood? We say, you know, a storm at a time. Meanwhile, you're looking for work and you're trying to kind of change your trajectory. And so, you know, our work is kind of to bring people into the neighborhood to try to hire people at high paying or, you know, good paying wages to try to offset that. But it's really hard work.
Michael, when we're thinking about wages, I wonder what you would say about that in terms of how much wages play a role in the issues that people living in poverty face with across the state, not just in Rockford.
Well, I think that wages, I think it's the fundamental part about how people can have access and contribute into society. So when wages are down or there's a large measure of income inequality, I think that it impacts not only their ability to just be able to live on a daily basis, but to do things such as what Jody's talking about in terms of having some assets, having some cushion to their lives in case something does happen.
Michael, I wonder what kind of trends you've seen regarding poverty and wealth inequality throughout Illinois. From your perspective, do you think things have improved in recent years?
I focus on about an 18-county region here in East Central Illinois. It's the counties that are generally covered by the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. And over the past 4 or 5 years that I've been doing this, poverty has pretty much remained flat. But what we do see, or what I've found, is that there's been a general uptick in what we call food insecurity. So, poverty is a measure of your income. It's a measure of how much money you make, whether it's in your household or as an individual, as a family. And the good news is that, you know, poverty has remained flat compared to this idea of food insecurity. So the income that we measure food insecurity at is almost twice as high as the poverty rate. And what we found is that, that food insecurity is going up. So people aren't necessarily technically living in poverty, but there's an increased number of families who are still at risk of every day maybe not having enough food to feed their whole family. There might be one life circumstance away from falling back into poverty. It might be something that they have to get repaired on their car, or some unforeseen health expense that they have to pay. And so wages really do play into this. And as we've seen with this Prosperity Now report and other measures, that as wages are down and income inequality continues to grow, more and more families might not be considered poor, but are still at an increased risk.
And Jody, to Michael's point, how much of this also has to do with debt? And in particular, I'm thinking not just about things like credit card debt, but student loan debt.
Debt is absolutely a big piece of this puzzle. There are a lot of families struggling with different kinds of debt across Illinois. And in fact, to your point about student loan debt, the scorecard data this year showed that 22.6% of Illinoisans with debt have student loan debt. And the median value of that debt is over $18,000, which is quite substantial. And I think, you know, beyond sort of student loan debt, which is definitely holding a lot of students back, I think one of the other big pieces that we're seeing is really fines and fees that are eating away at families' budgets. And those could be court-related fines and fees, traffic-related tickets or penalties. And then on top of that, I think we also see predatory lending. And so when families, are living on such tight incomes, we see that in times of financial crisis, oftentimes the payday lender or the car title lender is the available credit in your area. And so once folks are in these loans, they have 200 or 300% interest rates. And so a lot of folks struggle to be able to pay back those loans because they really are simply unaffordable. And so we see a lot of people get caught in that kind of debt as well. And so I think there are a lot of solutions that lawmakers can be pursuing to rein in some of these predatory lending practices, but also to reform debt collection and make sure that people have strong protections in the debt collection process.
Let's talk about solutions for a minute. Jody, you mentioned debt collection. You also talked about the bipartisan support that the state level earned income tax credit had. Grant, can I ask you, from a policy perspective, what would you like to see lawmakers be doing to address some of these issues as someone who deals with this on a day-to-day basis in the Rock River Valley area with the United Way?
Yeah, I mean, I think both the guests today are probably more educated to answer that. But on a just an anecdote level, you know, we talk to a lot of people who get low-paying jobs, who have multiple children, who, you know, fall off or walk into the benefits cliff, which is the idea that they end up making less money than they were on SNAP or on public benefits after they get the job. And I think that's something we talk about a lot, and I would like to see some type of, you know, proactive advocacy that we need to remedy that kind of, you know, drastic gap that happens at a certain threshold. And I'm not entirely sure, but there's a, you know, a monetary value where things drop off as far as benefits and the actual, you know, kind of drive to get that paycheck dwindles. And I think that's something I see and talk about every day.
Michael, that's a lot of what your research looks at. Can you weigh in here?
Yeah, I think that you know, that monetary level where the benefits and things start to drop off. Research shows, and it just isn't not in Illinois, it's across the country, that level is not enough. It's not enough to, once you get above that certain income threshold, you still can't participate at the level of somebody who might be in the middle or upper middle class and be able to access services, be able to just sort of participate in society. And so, you know, thinking about solutions, thinking about ways, some of the simplest things to do are just kind of help lift people up at a level that is previously done now. And you know, as mentioned before, things like student debt and student loan debt playing such an important role. Will are, you know, something as simple as helping students out while they're in school so that they can stay in school and maybe alleviate some of that debt. Are important things to do as well, because as we know, that debt just rolls over and rolls over as we get older. And so our state, for example, passed a bill last year that helps community college students in vocational programs become eligible for food stamps, which is a great idea to help students get, you know, those SNAP benefits. The problem that happened with that, though, was that there was no money or effort put behind actually promoting that program. So a lot of it has to do with education as well, and making sure that people understand all these programs and services and things that they might be eligible for, so that they can access them, so that they can make their lives better, and that they can lift themselves up as well.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up this conversation. Judy, I'd love to have you weigh in on other policy recommendations that Prosperity Now has, as well as you do with your work at the Heartland Alliance. As I said, we're talking about the annual Prosperity Now scorecard that looks at low and middle income families across Illinois. We will tweet out that link. If you want to hear that, it's a 21ST show is our Twitter handle. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll pick up this conversation just after this short break.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, presenting a public history exhibit in the north-south corridor of the University of Illinois Main Library throughout the month of February, with highlights from a century in publishing and design. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
You're listening to The 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're talking about Illinois' ranking 29th. In the country, according to Prosperity Now, for how we rank according to how low and middle income families are struggling despite all the economic improvements we've been talking about, our lowest jobless rate since 2006. Jody Blaylock is with me on the line from Chicago, where she's a senior policy associate at the Heartland Alliance and working with Prosperity Now on this report. Michael Gillespie is with us as well from Charleston, where he's an associate professor of sociology at EIU. On the line from Rockford, Grant Schubert is with United Way of Rock River Valley. Jody, really quickly, as we just have a couple minutes left here, I wanted to ask you two quick questions before we get to policy recommendations. What did you all find with the data about what this looks like in terms of race and in terms of how these numbers break down according to race and white and black households?
We see across the board racial disparities across all of these economic outcomes that are measured in the scorecard. And I think that's really concerning. So, you know, we talk about how unemployment rates right now are, lowest that they've been in years. But the unemployment rate among households of color is still 1.8 times that of white households. Poverty, 2.4 times higher for households of color. And then, you know, the list goes on. We see racial disparities across a number of other measures in terms of banking rates, liquid asset poverty rates, which is sort of a measure of savings. And so I think, you know, it's really very concerning that we, in a time of economic strength, that we're not seeing the economic gains shared by households of color. And so when we think, you know, when we talk a little bit about solutions, we need to really make sure that we're targeting low-income households, but also families of color, because we're really seeing inequity across the board.
That said, Jody, especially as we think about the 2-year-long budget impasse that the state went through, what kind of policy recommendations do you have for state lawmakers on this issue?
Sure. So we absolutely need a fully funded, responsible budget that invests in families and communities, supports higher education and social services. We need a stable economic climate. That's really the foundation. And, you know, I think we really need to fund our budget through a fair tax that, you know, is high, where higher rates apply to higher income levels and lower rates to lower income.
So a progressive tax, what you're saying, right, Jody? A progressive tax instead of the flat tax structure that we have now? Okay. Sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to make,
Yeah, that's perfectly fine. So a progressive tax is another name for the fair tax. And I think that is absolutely what we should be thinking about in terms of how we fund our government. We need more revenue right now. We're having a revenue crisis. We still have billions of dollars in backlog debt. And so we need to make sure that moving forward, we are generating enough revenue to support our state and invest in communities, but also that we're doing it in a way that's equitable and lifting up families and communities.
Right. Lots of recommendations there. As I said, we'll have the link at our website at 21stshow.org. We'll tweet it out as well at 21stshow if you'd like to see more about that. I want to thank Jody Blaylock with the Heartland Alliance, Grant Schubert with United Way of Rock River Valley, and EIU's Michael Gillespie for joining me. Thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nala.
Thanks for having me.
In December of 2016, a storage facility operated by Peoples Gas leaked into the largest aquifer in East Central Illinois, the Mahomet Aquifer. 5 homeowners had their water contaminated by this gas leak, but the public didn't even find out about this until months later. Governor Rauner responded by creating a Mahomet Aquifer Task Force, which he finished appointing members to late last year. One of those is Republican State Senator Chapin Rose, who's also introduced a series of his own bills designed to increase oversight of gas companies. We had a chance to speak with Senator Rose yesterday morning. He represents, by the way, Illinois' 51st Senate District, which includes parts of East Central Illinois, including Champaign County. Senator Rose, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I mentioned that leak at Peoples Gas in the Mahomet Aquifer. As we said, the public didn't find out until months later. For some affected homeowners, it was even up to a year. What do you think should have happened?
Oh, well, that's easy. There should have been immediate notification, first and foremost, to the folks in the vicinity who would be impacted by it, but also the local governmental bodies and the local media. I represent this area. I live about 5 miles from it. I found out about it about 9 months later as I was walking through a Panera in Champaign shaking hands, and my friend of mine said, hey, take a look at this text message I just got. And it was one of my constituents who was lighting their fire on their water on fire coming out of his tap at his home.
Oh,
that's how I found out about it. I mean, this is just, it was completely ridiculous and not only extremely dangerous, and you have obviously impacted homeowners, but you also have, there's 3 different wellheads in close proximity, the water supply for Fisher, the village of Mahomet, and then also rural Champaign County is on a co-op. You know, the co-op manager called me and said, hey, you know what? Nobody told me about this. And if this had gotten into my system, it could have blown my entire plant sky high and killed my employees, not to mention eventually shut off the water to everybody else on it. So, I mean, this is just, it was just bungled, and it continues to be bungled by the company. I mean, they've shown to date absolutely no seriousness to begin to quantify the problem, figure out where it is. There's been, you know, no studying, no 3D mapping. Their local team, who I think actually has tried to do the best they can, but they've been given no help at all by their corporate folks out of the greater Chicago area. And so, you know, you've got people down here who have a day-to-day job of trying to manage this natural gas storage field, and in their spare time, they're trying to clean up a big mess. And it's just been I mean, the response of Peoples Gas has been atrocious, absolutely atrocious. The bills I filed last week deal, you know, first of all, notice. There should have been more notice to the impacted families in the surrounding area. But also, frankly, people's gas from a storage perspective, they should have had an emergency action plan ready to go. They should have immediately hired a licensed environmental remediation experts. Those folks should be overseeing the cleanup, not the, you know, very small on-site staff they have who are trying to do their full-time jobs and, like I said, clean this up in their spare time. I mean, it's just their entire people's gas response has been awful.
Right. So, Senator, there's a couple of proposals you have that would try to change that. And let's talk about, you mentioned a couple of them. Let me ask you first about these inspections. How often would they have to happen? How much would the company have to pay for these things?
Well, first of all, I mean, and this isn't just limited to, and by the way, Mahomet's the largest aquifer in the state of Illinois. It's one of the largest aquifers in the entire Midwest. But this isn't just limited to the Mahomet. Nationally, you have an aging infrastructure, I think we're starting to see that infrastructure fail. And so one of the proposals I have is that the state DNR should inspect these things annually, not every 3 years, not every now and again, not, you know, but an annual inspection. It should be conducted by someone other than the company, and frankly, the company should pay for it, not the taxpayers. You know, one of the things that I think the task force is going to have to look at is the aging infrastructure in our nation. And of course, the task force only can deal with the state of Illinois. But also, frankly, to completely throw a curveball at you here, I first got involved in Protect the Mahomet Aquifer over a decade ago in a fight to keep CCBs off of our water supply, the storage of dangerous CCB waste off of our water supply, after the Quinn administration had permitted them at a local landfill. You know, one of the things you realize is that all across Illinois, on top of multiple water sources, are, you know, the old town dump, for lack of a better phrase, the old city landfill, things that were created before any kind of modern design standards, things that have no monitoring, things that have no nobody looking up on them and just seeing what's in it, where's it going. And, you know,
right. So, Senator, that's a huge issue, right? I mean, is that beyond the scope of the task force? Because
that's absolutely in the scope of the task force.
So what's the timeline for what the task force is accomplishing, and what's the timeline for your bills in terms of what you would like to
cover? So the task force was set up. It's supposed to report back by the end of June. My guess is that we're going to need to extend that to get any decent work product. But, the bills I filed this week are sort of narrowly tailored towards the gas storage issue. But the task force has a wide breadth of jurisdiction, and I hope and expect that it will cover other things like we just talked about, the, you know, what's in these old town dumps everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've said is that if the task force is productive and appears to be working well, then I think it will take my ideas and my concepts and improve upon them, and we'll get a better work product at the end of the day. I mean, I'm somebody that believes that the more people look at an issue, the better, you know, work product you're going to get. I certainly have no pride of ownership or authorship. On the other hand, if it appears that it's not going anywhere, then I intend to move my package of bills this session. So, you know, we're just going to kind of see how that unfolds. But I do think the task force is going to have to be extended, and frankly, I think it should be permanent. I mean, the fact that you don't have to hire a licensed contractor to clean up, I mean, that just says it all. I mean,
because you've also said you want to establish a fund, right, that would cover the costs of remediation.
Yep.
That's something I assume you would want people's gas to be paying for as well.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean,
just to be clear?
No, there's no requirement that they have that. And it's also, just to be clear, it's been over a year, and they have, you know, yet to determine exactly the extent of the leak, where it's at, you know, to sort of map and chart the parameters of it. It's been over a year. And, you know, like, well, we're going to install some relief wells. And so I'll ask the question, okay, well, if you don't know where the gas is, how do you know where to install the relief wells? Well, we're going to install some relief wells. I mean, that's just unacceptable. They should have had a corrective action. I mean, they should have had an emergency response plan in place. They followed the law as the law was, which was, you know, to call the EPA and the emergency management agencies, and then that was it. There was no knowledge, they say, well, we went around and we put some leaflets on some of the doors in the immediate vicinity. Well, all the leaflet said was, "This is people's gas. We stopped by to see you today." Didn't say, "Hey, there's a problem.
Gas leak in your
area.
There's
been a leak. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Call us immediately. It's imperative that you call us." It was just, "Oh, we stopped by. Sorry we missed you." I mean, that's...
And Illinois law doesn't require... There's no sort of protocol within Illinois law for how this should be handled as well?
First of all, the protocol in the federal law was to call these, you know, emergency lines and report it to sort of these superstructures, like the US EPA, who did no follow-up, like the, you know, state EPA, who didn't follow up on it for 10 months until I called them and asked them what the hell they were doing. Now, the State Department of Mines and Minerals had, in fact, followed up and was... working with some of the local homeowners, but I would suggest that was in and of itself was in a vacuum because no one had ever determined the true nature of the spill, so the DNR was only responding to the people who had called them with problems. So the people that were home the day that people's gas walked around and knocked on doors, for example, you know, those are the only people that knew to get tested. I mean, they didn't know anybody else to get, and no one else knew they should be tested. So, I mean, it was just, to me, it was just a sort of a monumental failure on all levels. But
last question for you, Senator. I know you have to go. Sure. How much have you talked to Governor Rauner about this? What is the sense you get from the Rauner administration about how important an issue this is?
Well, if you'll recall, Governor Rauner signed the TCLIP testing bill, which was the first ever attempt to limit toxic waste that came in from outside on top of into landfills for storage on top of aquifers. And so, you know, that's been helpful. I know the governor knows about, is very well aware of the aquifer issue. She's been through here several times on it and met with several local citizens, including signing that bill in the local community, again, to protect the water supply. But this system of series, you know, was logged over in the internal, somewhere in the internal superstructure of the Illinois EPA and sat there for 8 months. And I will tell you that since I called, the state EPA has gone out and they've tested 45 homes now, and they're actually in the process of doing the 3D mapping. But let me point that out right there, okay? That's not their job. TPL's gas is the one who screwed this up. There should be a licensed remediation contractor paid for by people's gas doing the 3D mapping, okay? Not the state of Illinois trying to back into this. And so, you know, you've had the State Department of Natural Resources, which, of course, who did respond, and they were the first to turn over a case in the Illinois Attorney General's office, and the AG's office has now put them into court, they being people's gas. You know, the EPA is a regulatory and oversight body. They're not a cleanup authority. And so you look at the lack of capacity, and then when you get into cleanup, it's through these through the lawsuit that comes through the Attorney General, which just takes, you know, months upon months and years of time potentially to get action. And that's just unacceptable for these landowners and these homeowners. People's Gas has a wealth of funds to spend on these lawsuits. You know, and I guess my point is, I would like to see us change the entire system so that you don't have to go to court months later to force a cleanup, but rather the cleanup is ready to go. And more to the point that we don't have to deal with the cleanup because we've been proactive in our monitoring and maintenance to prevent it from ever happening in the first place.
Thanks for your time, Senator Rose. It's Senator Chapin Rose. He's a Republican who represents Illinois' 51st Senate District. We'll check back in with you later in session and see if you're going to introduce these bills. Okay, thank you.
Hey, thank you. Have a nice day.
We reached out to People's Gas for comment, and they did respond with a statement. They told us they couldn't comment on Senator Rose's legislation until it was officially introduced. It's a lengthy statement. We'll post the entire thing online. But to sum up, People's Gas told us they agree with Senator Rose. They should have shared the leak information with a wider audience. They say their communication at the time was targeted just to the residents who were immediately affected. They also said they contacted local state and federal authorities during the early investigation of the leak back in December 2016. Finally, People's Gas says the Illinois EPA recently finished testing private wells in the area and said, quote, "No health impacts were identified as a result of the methane from our storage facility." They added they continue to work with the Illinois Attorney General, the Illinois EPA, and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources to make sure that nothing similar happens again. This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. We're continuing our series of interviews with candidates who'd like to be our next attorney general. Our current attorney general, Lisa Madigan, isn't running for re-election. There are 10 people hoping to replace her, 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans. A reminder, the primary's on March 20th. So here's how we did all of these interviews with the candidates. To be fair, we kind of did like a job interview where we tried to ask everyone almost all the same questions, and we recorded the interviews in advance so no one can say they got the questions ahead of time. Today, Pat Quinn is the former governor of Illinois, an office he held from 2009 to 2014. He also served as state treasurer for 4 years and the lieutenant governor of Illinois. He's one of 8 Democrats running for attorney general. Governor Quinn, welcome to the 21st.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Governor, I think many people were a little surprised when you put your hand up for this job, having served in a higher office previously. Why did you decide to run for attorney general?
Well, I think our democracy is in peril. Donald Trump is violating the law almost every single day, violating our federal constitution, our state constitution, and I think it's very important to have strong state attorney generals who are the last line of defense for our democracy. And when Lisa Madigan announced her retirement, I think everyone was surprised. But I think it's very important to have a strong voice from Illinois for everyday consumers and taxpayers and people who believe in decent health care. And that's why I'm running for attorney general, to be a lawyer for the people.
And what do you see as the main role? Is it to take on the Trump administration? What do you see as the main role right now for the Illinois attorney general?
Well, if Donald Trump and his allies and his cabinet break the law, I think it's very important to bring him to justice and use the law to uphold our state laws and constitution, as well as our federal laws and constitution. But I think most importantly, it's important for the attorney general, who's the lawyer for everyday people in Illinois. It's pretty hard for one person to take on a big corporation, a big utility company, a bank that's unfair, or an insurance company that's denying coverage. That's what attorney generals are for, to represent all of us, the everyday people who live from paycheck to paycheck. And I've done that all my life. I've been a lawyer, and I'm not a corporate lawyer. I represent everyday people, thousands of people over the years, and I know what their needs are, and I think it's important to have a strong voice for their needs when it comes to the attorney general's office.
Right. You went to Northwestern Law, I should add to our audience. You focused on tax attorney issues as well, right? I wanted to ask you what the most important priorities would be for you if elected attorney general.
Well, number one, I think we have to stand up to Commonwealth Edison and People's Gas and Nicor and Ameren, these utility companies who come down to Springfield and have lobbyists galore to try and raise their rates and have unfair practices. I started the Citizen Utility Board 35 years ago. It's still Illinois' largest consumer group, and I think the Attorney General has to work with CUB, the Citizen Utility Board, to fight against unfair practices by utilities. I also think the Attorney General has a strong role in protecting decent and affordable health care, because there are attacks on that by Trump and others. You know, insurance companies sometimes try to deny coverage of people who need health care coverage. So, again, the attorney general's got to be at the ready, a consumer lawyer, to make sure that our decent health care is provided, as well as people are not taken advantage of by the gas company or the phone company or the electric company.
Governor Quinn, as someone who's held the office of governor for the state, I wonder if that gives you, if how that informs your perspective as someone who would be working in the attorney general's office as opposed to the governor's office.
Well, I got a lot of laws that I signed when I was governor, important laws that especially advanced jobs and protected the wages of everyday people. I think it's important to raise the minimum wage. I fought hard for that when I was governor, and I also understand it's important to protect civil rights and human rights. Too often there are bureaucracies that take advantage of people. When I was governor, I signed a law that I advocated to protect women who were pregnant in the workplace. Some of their employers were making them lift heavy boxes and denying water breaks and just making it very hard for someone who was pregnant to do their job. So we passed a law protecting pregnant women in the workplace. And those are the kind of needs and issues that come up every day. And you have to have an attorney general who's out there on the side of the people. And I've been doing that all my life. I've never represented the big shots. I'm there for people who need a strong champion. And that's why I think Attorney General is a good place to be right now, because you can be the lawyer for the people of Illinois.
In a recent appearance before the Chicago Tribune editorial board, one of your Democratic opponents criticized your tenure as governor. When you were speaking about property taxes, Renato Mariotti said you didn't do anything about this while you were governor. What's your response to that, or to people who have criticized your tenure and saying, why should we trust you to be attorney general?
Well, I did a lot of important things to the people of Illinois when I was governor, and before that, lieutenant governor. We set up the Military Family Relief Trust Fund to help service members who were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. We helped over 15,000 men and women from Illinois who were in the reserves or National Guard. Oftentimes, their military salaries were below what they were making in civilian life, and over $15 million was raised to help them. And that's just one example of helping people who need a helping hand, and folks who answer the call to duty and serve our country. You know, sometimes in politics, there'll be people running for office who call you names or try and run you down. I've been in politics a while, public life. I got a strong back. You know, I'm running for office because I think I can serve the people, and I have always taken the ethic of service to heart. And I know from working with our military families and all our service members, they have that ethic of service, and all of us could do well to emulate them.
Governor Quinn, that said, there's seven other Democrats seeking the nomination this primary on March 20th. Why should voters choose you?
Well, I think I'm the best person to represent consumers and taxpayers and people who need decent health care. I know the state of Illinois like the back of my hand. It's a big state, one of the largest in the country. We need a strong attorney general that can always stand up to Trump when he's wrong, and also to make sure that people who are taken advantage of by big corporations and big utilities and big banks and unfair insurance companies, there's got to be a consumer advocate in the Attorney General's office. Some of my opponents are corporate lawyers, and they're taking thousands of dollars from the big utilities. Not me. I'm counting on everyday people. That's the only way I can win, and I think I will.
Pat Quinn is the former governor of Illinois, a position he held from 2009 to 2015. He's also, as you heard him say, been lieutenant governor and state treasurer, and one of eight candidates for the Democratic nomination for attorney general. Governor Quinn, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Rural parts of our state often don't get economic investment in the way that our cities do, but the state treasurer, Mike Frerichs, has just announced what the treasurer's office says may be the largest economic development program for rural Illinois ever to come from that office. He shared details of a $500 million new program this morning at the Champaign County Farm Bureau. The investment will be used to help local banks, who can in turn help farmers, homeowners, and employers who are seeking loans. The state treasurer is with me now in our Urbana studios. Treasurer Frerichs, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Nyla, it's great to be back.
So maybe you can explain a little bit of the goal of this investment, because this isn't a direct loan program. This is you all investing in banks.
So we're putting money into banks, and then they in turn invest in or issue loans for farmers, for people who are first-time home buyers, or perhaps for businesses looking to expand in rural Illinois. You know, I grew up not too far from this studio, about 25 miles away from here in Gifford, Illinois, in a small town. And when I came into this office, I wanted to make sure that we're investing throughout the state of Illinois, not just in Chicago, not just in the big banks, but we want to put money in banks throughout the community, providing capital to people to help grow downstate rural economies.
Treasurer Frerichs, we were actually just talking at the beginning of this program about the Prosperity Now report that came out looking at low-income and middle-income families. One of the things that came up actually was predatory lending, and I wanted to ask how you think programs like this will help people. I wonder how much you think, we tend to think of predatory lending as a problem more in cities, but is this also a problem in rural areas?
Yeah, you see it throughout the state of Illinois. That's something that we need to address, is the people who are charging extraordinarily high interest rates for people who have needs. But rather than just complaining or capping them, we want to make sure that we have access to capital. So our community uplift program is putting money into banks that have facilities in enterprise zones. you know, people think of it as a problem in large urban areas, but there are counties in downstate Illinois that don't have any banks. We want to make sure that our agricultural economy, which is the number one industry in the state of Illinois, the farmers have access to capital at low rates so that they can put a crop in the field and take it out. But they can also invest that money in their own operations to modernize, to make changes, become more efficient, to make them more productive.
So some of these programs might be familiar to people. There's two programs that this builds on. One of them is Ag Invest. What is that about, and how will this new investment change that?
So Ag Invest is the longest running link deposit program in Illinois. For over 30 years, we've had Ag Invest. We've given out over $1 billion in loans, and it can be used for short-term loans to, like I said, to get through the growing season, or longer-term loans if they want to make an investment in equipment or tiling for their farms. So this is something we give some below-market loan rates here to encourage this sort of investment, because this is a real wealth generator for our state. When we create wealth through our farming enterprises, it spreads out into these rural areas as well.
There's also another program, Finally Home. How will this help people who might not be able to qualify for a traditional mortgage?
It's exactly for them. The Treasurer's Office is not trying to be the next Fannie Mae. We're not trying to duplicate the work being done out there. But there are some people out there who perhaps have a good enough credit score, but they have some other issues that they need just a little bit of extra help in order to qualify for their mortgage, especially with a lot of first-time home buyers. So we're trying to help those people on the margins, because we know that when people have home ownership, they take greater pride in this. It helps them to build some wealth out there, and that's what we want to do.
Treasurer Ferris, you mentioned that there's a lot of counties that don't actually even have a bricks-and-mortar bank. How will this, I wonder what banks you're working with, how this will help maybe expand a banking presence throughout the state?
Well, so there are already about 300 pre-qualified banks throughout the state of Illinois. We would like to expand that number. And one of the things is access to capital. I think there are some people who just aren't saving as much as they used to. You don't have that brick-and-mortar bank where someone goes in and puts a deposit in their account. And we're trying to provide capital. You know, we're not trying to be the solution to everything, to all the state's problems, but to be part of the solution. We don't have to create our own state bank. We already have banks out there. We partner with them. We leverage their relationships and their assets. We can help more people.
Where's the money for this coming from?
So our general revenue fund is short of funds. It's long on bills. But there are over 700 different special purpose funds in state government. As the money builds in those funds waiting to be used for the special purpose, we invest that money. So we invest in things like treasury notes or commercial paper, repurchase agreements, but we can also make some longer-term loans as well. We have about $12 billion on average sitting in our state funds, and our job is twofold. One, to make money for the state. Every dollar in interest we earn is a dollar that the governor of the General Assembly don't have to raise in taxes or cuts they don't have to make to things like education. But also, we target those investments that help create wealth, that help create jobs throughout our state. And those people, in turn, then pay taxes. That helps the General Revenue Fund as well.
How can people find out more information about this?
Anything they are interested in, they can go to illinoistreasurer.gov. And we also have to encourage people, when they're looking there, they should look at our unclaimed property or iCash and see if we have some money that belongs to them. I can tell you, when we write these checks and they get into people's hands and their pockets and they spend them in their local community, it does a lot more good for the local economy than it does sitting in a bank account in Springfield.
That's State Treasurer Mike Frerix joining us to talk about this new program. As he said, all of the details are at the State Treasurer's website, where you can also, as always, check and see if the state owes you money. That's what everybody always, it's money there for the taking, right?
So we'd like to get money to them. We'd also like to help them invest in themselves. They can also look at college savings accounts and set up for a child or grandchild or niece or nephew, put them on a pathway to success by making an investment in a young person.
Thanks for being with us.
Nyla, thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes or Android, however you get your podcasts. By the way, if you have Alexa and NPR One, you can play us there. Just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, every way to contact us, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. That's also where we have our handles for Twitter and Facebook, so you can connect with us there. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Grace Stetson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.